Welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine Story Podcast Series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. At the 2012 BoucherCon in Cleveland, I caught up with L.A. Wilson Jr., who will read his short story, Jazz Reed. L.A. Wilson's story, Dancer in the Storm, which appeared in our January-February 2011 issue, was a finalist for Seamus Award for Best Private Eye Short Story. Jazz Reed was originally published in our November 1997 issue. We've reprinted it in our electronic anthology, Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine Presents 13 Tales of New American Gothic.
I must have been almost 40 years old when I first paid any attention to what they call senile dementia. It first garnered my attention when Uncle Raymond wandered outside at 3 a.m. one November morning, sat down in a creek behind his house, and damn near froze to death. Uncle Raymond had always been my favorite uncle, the one who gave me my first drink of beer and bought me a new rubber because the one I carried in my wallet had been there so long it was beginning to dry rot. Sometime after he recovered, I asked him why he had done such a foolish thing, and he mumbled something unintelligible at me, causing Aunt Corrine to shake her head with pity while whispering, "Poor old fella," over and over. His gobbled words just wouldn't leave my mind. He had always been a man who was lucid and in control of his wits, and I have no words for the pain it caused me not to be able to hold a conversation with him. I was about 200 miles from Roanoke Rapids on my way back to Atlanta when one of the words he had mumbled finally recirculated in my brain until it coalesced into some kind of recognizable form. It was a name, unfamiliar and strange, Jazz Reed. About every 2 months, I struggled up enough energy to make the 8-hour drive from Atlanta to Macon, North Carolina, to see the remnants of my family. It seemed to be something that I needed in order to make some sense out of the various identities that constantly struggled for preeminence in my brain. The Atlanta Police Department's Big Al Ivy still had an unyielding yearning to become Albert Lee and be doted over by friends and family under circumstances where nothing was required and nothing was expected. On this visit, I had journeyed to Roanoke Rapids, a few miles down the road from Macon, where I discovered another identity that I was learning to enjoy. To 11-year-old Robert Sherrod, I was Cousin Albert, who seemed to conjure up a myriad of fascinating images in his mind. I was sure it was because he pictured me as one of the gun-toting, butt-kicking, irreverent superheroes that seemed to fill all the movie screens. I hadn't done much to discourage the notion. It fed my ego, and I convinced myself that kids needed heroes, so what the hell? We walked down the long, winding path whose central tuft of weeds was flanked by bare dirt packed hard by countless tractor and truck tires. Robert crept, stalked, and slipped noiselessly through the brush, flanking a pine grove that was much smaller than I remembered from my youth. He clutched his fishing pole like a rifle, playing the same games that I remembered so well from my own childhood. He darted ahead of me and out of sight, heading for a small stream that flowed through the property from the nearby Roanoke River. It was a place of warm memories, tinged with the sadness and the knowledge of friends and family from a long time ago who were gone forever. I stepped into a dry creek bed and felt an instant rush of bitter memories. It was the place where Uncle Raymond's failing mind had brought him to sit in his freezing waters as if impatient to feel death's chilly touch. The creek was gone now, undoubtedly a victim of some development far from here that had diverted its waters elsewhere. Suddenly, Robert's voice exploded my memories. It displayed a mixture of fear and excitement. I stumbled through the bushes trying to follow the sound of his yelling. "Cousin Albert, quick, come see this." He was standing in the creek bed near a large cement pipe that had once sent water under one of the paths that crisscrossed the woods. The place was overgrown with reeds and wild holly, and it was hard to move without suffering the scratches and needle-like pricks that the foliage inflicted. "Look," Look down in the pipe, he insisted. I moved past Robert and used the end of my fishing rod to push back the brush so I could peer inside. The visual shock ripped through me like a jolt of electricity. I dropped the rod and jumped backwards, falling on my butt and hyperventilating myself into a dizzy state. It was gone before I had even hit the ground. It had been there for only the briefest instant, disappearing in less than the blink of an eye. I scrambled to my feet and peered again into the dingy light within the pipe. It was empty, but she had been there. The image, no matter how transient, was still imprinted on my brain. A woman dressed in something dark had sat there staring back at me. Robert, what the hell did you see in there? He didn't answer at first. I could see the astonished look on his face as he watched my strange reaction, a reaction that had apparently frightened him. It's all right, man. I tried to reassure him. What did you see? Why'd you call me? Just that, he answered, nervously pointing inside the pipe. I stepped closer again and used the fishing rod to sweep away the spider webs that hung thickly inside the pipe. In the dried gray mud on the floor of the pipe were partly covered bones. They were large bones, human bones. A skull's hollow eyes looked up at us, and I backed out of the pipe. I didn't consider myself a superstitious man, but being there just didn't feel right. The place had an ugliness about it that defied explanation. It filled me with dread. There had been something there for which being a policeman had done nothing to prepare me. It wasn't the bones. It was like a smell that only the subconscious could detect. What else? What else did you see? Nothing, he stammered. What did you see? Nothing, I sighed. Nothing. Let's get away from here. We need to let Isaac know about these bones. This is a job for the police. We don't need to be here. Yes, sir. He never said yes, sir, to me before. I knew he was afraid. I draped my arm around his shoulders as we walked back. He didn't feel much like talking, and neither did I. I owed Briscoe Falcon a visit. For the past 30 years, he had continuously been the most amazing man I had known. I had no doubt that he'd consumed at least a pint of whiskey every day of his adult life without ever getting cirrhosis. I, like most people, couldn't remember a day when I hadn't smelled liquor on his breath. There was something to be admired about Briscoe, however. He was somewhere in his 80s and had been his own man all his life. He had been my father's acquaintance and my uncle's old road dog. My mother claimed she hated him, but in truth, everybody harbored a little respect for the old man who never took any crap and grew old just the way he wanted. A few years before, he had shotgunned a man he thought had done a disservice to an elderly lady friend. Everybody just shook their heads and mumbled his name under their breaths disapprovingly while the sheriff tried to figure out what to do with him. The incident just heightened my respect for him. It took balls to go after a man less than half his age with a gun, but Briscoe was that kind of man, and I kept close to him because I knew his kind wouldn't come along again during my lifetime. I sat in his cluttered little add-on room behind his sister's house and tried to see if I had truly arrived yet, if I could finish a glass of Jack Daniels before he finished the pint. He shook his head disparagingly as he watched me frown in response to the alcohol sting in my throat. Don't feel bad. Your daddy couldn't drink either. He grinned sympathetically and scratched his head through his uncombed afro. I hear y'all found some bones out behind Raymond's house. Small towns were like that. I didn't even bother to ask him how he knew. You helping Isaac out with it, he asked. Nah, I got to get back to Atlanta in a couple of days. I just came down here to check on Mama. You don't have to worry about your Mama. I'll check on her for you. All right, now watch your mouth. I don't play that. I didn't mean it that way, he laughingly protested. Hell, I've been knowing that girl since we were in grade school. I mean, I'll look out for her. I slapped him on the leg, although I knew from the twinkle in his eye that he hadn't taken me seriously anyway. Y'all find out who them bones belong to, he asked. I don't think so, but I haven't been keeping up with it. Isaac said the crime lab told him they might have been there 40 to 50 years. They know it's a woman and that's it. Hell, if y'all waiting for Isaac to get something done, it ain't gonna never happen. That boy's slow as black molasses. Always been slow, even before he got to be county sheriff. All right, now lay off Isaac, that's my boy. And give me some more of that liquor before you finish the ball. You ain't finished that you already got, Briscoe complained. The way you're going, when I do finish, there won't be none left. Come on, pour me some more. Briscoe reluctantly poured a thimbleful of additional whiskey in my glass. You know, everybody in town's got an opinion about those bones, Mr. Falcon, I said. My aunt thinks it's somebody the Klan killed. You've been here longer than most folks. Who you think it is? He took another sip and answered quickly as if he didn't have to think about it. Could be Jazreen. The name jerked my head upward in instant recognition. Uncle Raymond had been dead for over 2 years. He had a stroke a year after he wandered into the creek behind his house. I still remembered his garbled words that I had finally figured out on the way back home. Jazreen. Here was the name again, and it was pulling me into a place where I really didn't want to go. This wasn't my problem. It was something curious, an oddity. But I was a policeman, and it called to me. Questions and mysteries burned away at people like me. Then there was the thing, the face, whatever it was that fooled me, tricked my mind, and made me think I saw something in that pipe. I shoved it aside, refused to talk or think about it, but it was there, just gnawing away and pissing me off just enough to make me consider. That was one bad bitch, Briscoe muttered absently, as if reflecting on something much deeper. That's one piece of ass I'm glad I didn't ever get. I reckon I was too old for her anyway, but hell, I was younger than Crawford Sanderson, and better looking, too. Who was she? I heard Uncle Raymond call her name. Did he know her? Briscoe took a last gulp of whiskey without answering. He leaned back in his chair and just looked at me for a long time. I ain't got no right to talk about that woman, he finally said, almost apologetically. She left from around here back in 48 or 49. Hell, I'm getting sleepy. Liquor used to not bother me like that. You think I'm getting old? I scrutinized him for a few seconds before answering, nah, and we both laughed. I left Briscoe without thinking about the woman or the bones much. I had a job to go back to in Atlanta. Everybody in this rural county was always fond of saying how the Lord moves in mysterious ways. I had always thought it was a figure of speech, but I was to find out differently, and very soon. Abba Lee, this is Isaac. I'm down here at the County Extension Service. It's your mama. I think she's had a stroke. You better meet us at Halifax Memorial. Isaac's voice had been as morose and serious as I had ever heard it. His words were played over and over in my mind as I raced to the hospital. I had just dropped her off for her quilting class and gone back home to pack for my drive to Atlanta later that day. All I could think about was whether there was something I should have noticed about her, something that could have saved her and me from this pain. It was a type of pain that seemed to haunt little towns like Macon. Every time I returned there was a litany of names of people we had known and loved most of our lives who were now dead or dying. A few years ago it had been my father, then Uncle Raymond, and now my mother. I drove the few miles from Macon to the county hospital in Roanoke Rapids and found my mother smiling at me and repeating one of her favorite sayings, all sickness ain't death. She had no residual weakness from whatever had happened to her, but the doctors decided to keep her anyway. If nothing else, hospitalizing her made me feel better. I called Atlanta from her room to tell my chief that I didn't know when I was going to return. Isaac Johnson sat with us for a long time. We had grown up together, and Mama had taught him in elementary school, so he felt like family. Isaac was a man with mental limitations, but he knew his job and had done it well enough to move from the one-man police force of Macon to county sheriff. I could tell from the way he fidgeted and made repetitive small talk that he had something on his mind beside my mother's health. He finally got it out when I decided to take a break from the hospital for a while. You know, I was over to Uncle Raymond's house yesterday. The Roanoke Rapids police don't want to fool with those bones you found since it was outside the town limits, Isaac began. Everybody still referred to everything Uncle Raymond had owned as his, as if Aunt Corrine didn't exist. "So it's all on you?" I asked. "Yeah, I guess. You know, I asked Ms. Corrine whether she remembered anything funny going on around there back in the 50s, and she cussed me out. Damn near ran me off. I don't know what I said to piss her off." Isaac looked at me in that penetrating, inquisitive way that implied he was very serious, although he had chosen to broach the subject somewhat indirectly. It was a behavior quirk that caused outsiders to underestimate men like Isaac, assuming they were dumb when they were really simply adhering to a Southern tradition of politeness and respect. Our friendship demanded that he avoid the discourtesy of asking me directly if my aging aunt was acting suspiciously because she had something to do with those bones. "I don't know either, Isaac, but I'll talk to her. Maybe you just caught her on a bad day." "Maybe. You let me know what she says here." I hadn't quite lied to my friend Isaac, but I wasn't about to ask Aunt Corrine about anything that might get her fired up. She was an excitable woman who took tranquilizers most days just to lower her level of agitation to some functional plateau. I always wondered if Uncle Raymond's trek outside on that cold November night was really an attempt to escape from his wife. Aunt Corrine was out chopping wood when I arrived. She still cooked on a wood stove that my grandmother used to own. I suspected that the old stove was worth more than her whole house. I was surprised to find a well-dressed white man in his mid-30s apparently engrossed in a rather serious conversation with her. He stopped talking as I drove up and blocked his car with my own. "Hey, Aunt Corrine, I just stopped by to let you know that Mama was in the hospital. She had a light stroke this morning. She seems like she's all right, though." "Lord have mercy," she exclaimed fearfully. "You sure she's all right?" "Yeah, she was smiling and talking when I left." The man stood to the side watching us sullenly, looking annoyed at having been interrupted. Aunt Corrine came nearer to me as she continued to inquire about Mama. Some of what she asked was repetitive and unimportant, and I got the feeling she was pushing the conversation to get me to stay. "Who is this?" I finally asked. "Oh, this is Mr. Flowers. He's a lawyer." Flowers fidgeted impatiently and made no move to greet me or be civil. "And what does my aunt need with a lawyer?" I asked. "I was just interested in a few things about the property. Nothing really important," he said. "It was important enough for you to drive out here," I countered. "I'm not really at liberty." "He wants to know where you found those bones," Aunt Corrine explained. "What's it to you?" I asked. "Nothing really." "Then you really don't need to be here, do you?" I had him on the defensive, and I planned to keep it that way. Lawyers have a way of worming their way into your business before you know there's an advantage in it for somebody. They're never completely straight with you, and by the time you finally figure out what's going on, they've already scammed you and left. "Look, I wouldn't want your aunt to get in any trouble with the police," he began. "What police?" I asked. "The Roanoke Rapids police are out of it. This is county jurisdiction, and I know for a fact that the county police didn't send you." The man grinned sheepishly at me and tried again to convince me of his sincerity. "Look, all I want to do is see the place where you found the bones. Look it over, take a few pictures." "I don't think so. I don't think you want to upset certain people around here, Mr. Ivy." The tone of his voice shifted radically. "I really don't give a damn," I taunted him. He knew my name, and I could surmise that there were other things in his devious little mind that he knew and would keep hidden. "Maybe you should. And maybe you should take to wearing a bulletproof vest when you go where you're not wanted." His jaws went rigid, and his skin flushed almost as red as his hair. He gritted his teeth and glared at me as if he were trying to gain control of himself. I knew he really wasn't. He was too small and too soft to think about doing anything except talking. He walked briskly back to his car and spent a few minutes maneuvering it so he wouldn't have to ask me to move mine. "Looks like you take more after your uncle than your daddy. You talk about as much trash as Raymond did," Aunt Corrine chuckled. "Can you drive me over to the hospital to see your mama? I ain't gonna feel right until I lay eyes on her myself." I was more than happy to do that. I still hadn't worked up enough nerve to ask her about her encounter with Isaac. Getting her out of the house, however, would give me the chance to find out why this lawyer was so interested in seeing where I found the bones. Searching a 40-year-old crime scene is pretty much a waste, and nobody had made any effort to do it except for picking up as many bones as could be found. I sat on the shallow bank of the stream bed, wondering where to start. There had been a minimum amount of digging in the sediment of the pipe, but the place was otherwise undisturbed. At some point, I became aware that my heart was pounding as a vaguely sensed anxiety began to build deep inside me. The memory of the discovery rushed in on me, the woman, the face, there for a fraction of a second. Was it real? What could it have been? Christ, why did I feel this way? Like something was here besides me. I was becoming overwhelmed by an almost oppressive feeling of dread. I wanted to leave. I felt compelled to leave there immediately, but I couldn't, at least not yet. I got down on my knees in the stream bed and began to scrape the soil with a small pocket knife. I don't know why. I think I saw an archaeologist doing it in a National Geographic magazine, only he had a brush. I kept at it for a long time, and I don't know why I was so persistent with so little to be found. Eventually, I found a couple of small bones. I suspected they were what was left of some fingers. I picked a small piece of mud-caked metal out of the soil. I spit on it and rubbed it until I could at least identify it as the front of an earring. Suddenly, it got cold, bone-chilling cold. I had that feeling that I was being watched. My heart started to pound again. I knew somebody was standing behind me, and the more I thought about it, the surer I was of its reality. I wanted to turn, but was terrified to do so. It wasn't little freckle-faced white lawyers that I was afraid of. I didn't want to think of what I really feared. I made myself turn anyway. I jerked around, stretching my eyes wide, but nothing was there. It was then I realized that I had spent 4 hours digging in that stream bed, and I knew that Aunt Corrine was ready to come home by now. It was my excuse to leave. I couldn't keep thinking about what was there. Men didn't scare me, but I wasn't prepared to cope with my imagination. I waited until Aunt Corrine was back home before continuing to clean the small gold earring. Although it had been caked with hardened mud, its luster returned immediately under a warm stream of water. The gold sparkle seemed untainted by time or the elements. On its gently concave surface was a delicate and intricate inscription of the letter J. I found this in the creek bed while you were at the hospital, I informed her. She walked nearer to the kitchen sink where I stood cleaning the earring. She seemed to deliberately maintain a relative proximity, but was careful not to approach too close. She stood back and craned her neck slightly to see what I was holding. Here, take a look at it. I handed her the earring, but she moved quickly away in order to avoid taking it. I ain't got no use for that. Take a look at it, I insisted. It's got a J inscribed on it. She glanced toward it briefly, then averted her eyes to something else in the room that was irrelevant and unimportant. Get that out of here. I don't like dead folks' stuff in my house. She walked away as she spoke. You ever heard of a woman named Jazrine? I finally got enough nerve to ask her a question directly. She stopped abruptly, but didn't turn. Where'd you hear that name? She asked in a subdued voice. Briscoe Falcon. He was wondering if those bones I found belonged to somebody named Jazrine. I don't know why you paid any attention to that drunken old bastard. I don't know nothing about no Jazrine, and you need to get away from here asking me about something like that. Aunt Corrine, I know this might sound crazy, but when I first looked in that pipe before I saw the bones, I saw a woman sitting in there. I just saw her for a second, and then she disappeared. When she turned, her face was seething, and her words erupted like venom. Boy, you better get away from around me with that. I don't want to hear nothing else about it. I don't appreciate you coming over here with this, and you ain't got no business snooping around my property like that. You ain't the police. Not here, you ain't. This was just what I feared. Aunt Corrine could be a raging, nonstop maniac when something got her fired up. The timbre of her voice seemed to rise in excited progression. She had spent 8 months in the state mental hospital in Goldsboro a long time ago over something nobody ever wanted to talk about. It didn't take any smarts to see my best move was to get the hell out of there and let her calm down. Nothing is worse than to be in law enforcement and have the tormenting feeling that a member of your own family might be involved in something dirty. I couldn't imagine Aunt Corrine being involved in killing anyone, but I didn't know her when she was a younger woman and perhaps controlled by different passions. I couldn't ask my mother anything at this point. The last thing she needed now was to get riled up over some ancient ugliness that should never have been found. The next day, I pulled my car into the bare dirt yard in front of a small shack whose remnants of white paint were now a peeling sheet of dull gray. There were rusting metal signs nailed to the sides with just enough paint remaining to identify the appetizers as Knee-High Grape and Esso. The inside wasn't much better off than the exterior. It was dark in there and smelled of a mixture of stale sweat, tobacco smoke, and whiskey. It took several seconds for my eyes to adjust to the light. There were a few tables with mismatched chairs and a surprising number of men sitting around shooting the bull and drinking. I had thought that places like this had disappeared years ago. I could still remember my mother telling us to walk on the other side of the road when we passed that juke joint. She didn't want us to be influenced by getting too close to that den of iniquity where the ne'er-do-wells gathered to get drunk on bootleg liquor. I never told her that Uncle Raymond had taken me in there when I was 7 or 8 and given me my first sip of beer. It had been a place of wonder where bad men who talked trash and carried knives and guns exchanged stories of their daring deeds. It had been a place that filled a small boy's innocent mind with fantasies of excitement and adventure. Briscoe Falcon was sitting alone at the same rickety table where I remembered meeting him during my childhood. I'd known he would be there. It was the only place in town for old men to go when they got tired of drinking at home. I really couldn't tell if the place had changed. I still couldn't see much better in there than I could when I was 8. The jukebox was gone, probably died of an old age, and had been replaced by a vintage record player that looked as if it was as old as the building. It was playing 33 and a third albums that produced the scratchy B.B. King. Everybody in the place looked like they were over 70, except the bartender, whose bar was a cluster of salvaged kitchen cabinets. Briscoe looked up at me as I helped myself to a chair at his table. He began to shake his head negatively and shoved his half-empty glass toward me. He seemed to know why I was there, but I went on anyway. I asked Aunt Corrine about Jazreen, and she went off on me. "What'd you want to go and do that for? Boy, you crazy as hell." I found this over by the pipe. I dropped the earring on the table in front of him and took a sip of straight whiskey from his glass. He responded uninterestedly. "Mr. Falcon, who is Jazreen?" "It ain't my place to tell you about your family's business." He reached for his drink again. "You want to tell me what that means?" He didn't answer. "That was a white man at Aunt Corrine's when I got there. Middle 30s, red hair. She said he was a lawyer. I know him, Lester Flowers. He's one of them closet Ku Kluxers." He took a deep breath and let it out slowly. "Boy, you done stirred up some deep mess. Everything that's wrong don't need to be made right. Some things just need to be left alone. God damn, how can y'all sit around here listening to this damn crap?" I was startled, not by the epithets, but by the youthfulness of the voice that uttered them. They were followed by a harsh scratch as the needle was snatched from the record. The next sound was the reverberating thump of the bass speakers of a boombox. "Little young-ass son of a bitch," Briscoe muttered. "I didn't come here to listen to that." He wrinkled his face in disgust as he spoke. "Who's that?" I asked, perusing the young man rocking back and forth to the beat of his music with one of his friends. They appeared to be in their late teens. "Packer's boy. He thinks because his daddy owns this little joint, he can do anything he wants to do. He ain't nothing, dropped out of school, don't work, probably sells dope." While I was looking at the two of them, I caught Briscoe's movement from the corner of my eye as he encouraged his stiffened joints to take him over to the record player where he started B.B. King playing again. The young man cursed and reached for the record player, but Briscoe pushed him away in a sweep of his hand, shoved the boombox off the table, letting it crash to the floor and silencing it. The young man erupted with a string of obscenities and made a move as if he were going to pounce on Briscoe. I jumped out of my chair and started across the floor to stop the confrontation, just as a deafening explosion shook the room and the old men, who seemed to have only enough energy to lift their glasses, all hit the floor like army recruits dodging incoming mortars. Briscoe hadn't fired a warning shot. He just missed. His next shot wasn't going to miss, however, because the old 45's muzzle was only a foot from the first boy's chest. His hand had that slow, rhythmical, senile tremor, but there was nothing wrong with his resolve. I could see his finger tightening on the trigger, and I knew I wouldn't get there in time. Briscoe! I never called him by his first name, and maybe that caused him to hesitate for a moment. I kicked the first boy in the crotch, and he doubled up toward the floor in time for his face to meet my knee. It jerked him upward and put him on his back. The second boy stood there frozen, since he seemed next in line for Briscoe's bullet. Briscoe looked at me, a bit bewildered, as if to ask what should he do now that his initial target was down. I shrugged as if I couldn't figure it out either. "I really don't feel like this much trouble today," I said to him. "Why don't we just get the hell out of here?" I reached gingerly for the gun, and he released it without resistance. As I walked past the second boy, I used it to give him a harsh crack on the back of his head, sending him sprawling. Briscoe frowned disapprovingly at me. "You're a dirty son of a bitch," he observed, as if completely surprised. "That what them police in Atlanta been teaching you?" "Makes up for some of the spankings his mama didn't give him," I said. That brought a grin to his face as we walked out to the car. "Jazreen was your first cousin." Briscoe started talking spontaneously as we rode away from the juke joint. He had apparently come to the conclusion that I deserved to share in whatever knowledge he had. "She was Raymond's daughter." He cut his eye at me to see my reaction. I was too shocked to do anything except sit there with my mouth agape. Raymond was screwing this white gal. Poor white trash, lived on the other side of town over by the river. That was way before you were born. The gal got pregnant and must have lost her mind because she wanted to run off with Raymond. Hell, won't nobody in their right mind gonna run off with no white gal back then. Plus, Raymond was married, and you know Corrine won't gonna hear no mess like that. Well, that gal went off to Color Town. They call it Rosemary now. She went to live with Elvira Smith's people. Well, she had the baby, and damned if the baby didn't look white. I guess that was all she needed. Looked like once she found out she wasn't gonna have no nigger baby, she was all right. She left from down there, and ain't nobody seen her no more. She take the baby with her, I asked. That's right. Both of them left town. Now, about 47 or 48, there was a picture in the paper of this woman, white woman, marrying Crawford Sanderson. Her name was Jazreen Smith. Pretty gal. Looked like a Hollywood star or something. Elvira said it was that white gal's baby. Elvira was the one that named her Jazreen. We figured her mama just moved to another town and changed her name so none of her people would know where to find her. Who's Crawford Sanderson? Oh, I forgot. You're a youngster. You're from Macon, and you don't really know about all the old stuff that used to go on in this town. The Sanderson family was big shots around here. They the same ones that owned the paper mill. Important white folks, don't you know? Well, they says that Jazreen ran off and left him after about a year. That ain't what everybody says, though. Briscoe was enjoying himself. He was stretching the story out and teasing me with it. I was mesmerized. I couldn't keep driving, so I pulled off the road at one of the state ABC stores and bought Briscoe a half pint and helped him drink it right there in the parking lot. "I heard she had a baby," he continued. "I heard that the midwife that caught that baby said it popped out just as dark as you and me. Ain't nobody seen Jazreen since then." "Did Uncle Raymond know who she was?" "I don't know whether he did or not. Raymond never talked about it. I know one thing. Corrine knew Raymond was screwing that white gal, and she knew that was Raymond's baby. Don't you know Raymond had enough sense to keep his mouth shut? With all due respect to your aunt, he didn't need to get that woman on his ass. She was rough enough when she was in a good mood." "You think Sanderson killed her?" I asked. "Sanderson, one of his brothers, the Klan, the police. I don't see what difference it makes. Ain't nobody gonna ever do no time for it. Killing a nigga wasn't no big thing back then. When he saw that baby, he might have figured she was a nigga passing for white. Or maybe she was just screwing a nigga on the side. Hell, it would all come out to the same thing anyway. What happened to the baby?" "I don't know. I don't really know none of it no way. It's just what I heard over the years. It's just stories. I dropped Briscoe off at his sister's house, and he asked me for his gun. I asked him if I could hold it for a while, and he agreed. He knew I was trying to keep him from hurting somebody, and he figured I might need it more than him for the time being. Now, Abba Lee, don't you take my gun back to Atlanta with you. I done got too old to fight, and these young boys will kick your ass if you ain't got nothing with you." I shook his hand and promised to return his weapon. It wasn't just the young boys I had to worry about. Dragging up a killing could put a lot of folks over the edge. Briscoe told me about one thing that inexplicably needled me more than the others, the Sandersons' big wedding. That led me to the Herald, Roanoke Rapids' small but venerable newspaper, where I met a friendly young woman who was too blonde to have demonstrable eyebrows. She seemed more than happy to help me find an old newspaper article until I frustrated her with my lack of information, no specific dates. She finally called an older woman who remembered that the newspaper kept a special file of major events in the town, and Crawford Sanderson's 1948 marriage was the most major event that the little town had seen in its entire history. In less than 20 minutes, I found myself staring at a picture that covered a quarter of a page of a beautiful young woman in a white wedding gown. I had no need to read the caption. I knew who the woman was instantly. The eyes and the face were hauntingly familiar. They were also frightening. I had seen her before, the figure in the pipe, something that survived even her death. My eyes were drawn to her ears. The picture wasn't sharp enough to show an inscription, but I knew. The small, rounded shape was the same as the earring I had found. This woman and the bones in the creek were the same. This was Jazreen. I ran into Isaac on the way home and stopped to talk briefly. Isaac had moved on to other things. This case wasn't very important to him, and I could understand why. It was a 46-year-old mystery, and how many resources was he going to invest in it to more than likely just come up empty? His concern about Aunt Corrine's behavior seemed a thing of the past, even in the unlikely event that she was responsible for Jazreen's death. What were his chances of developing a case? And what the hell could he do to an 83-year-old woman anyway? I remained interested only because this was my family. And what I had seen in that pipe was more overwhelming than anything else I had encountered during my life. The following day, I drove my mother home from the hospital. She had fully recovered and was already making plans for a number of things that her doctor had completely prohibited. I learned that I should have talked to her in the first place. My dear, sweet, gossiping mother knew more of the town's dirt than a gossip columnist. I had assumed that Crawford Sanderson was dead. After all, he was 20 years older than Jazreen when he married her. That would make him over 90 by now. My mother knew where to find him, so we made a stop at the local nursing home. Crawford Sanderson might not have been dead, but his brain was. The man didn't know he was alive and in the world. I left him lying in bed, smelling like a giant bed sore. Being rich didn't seem to make a hell of a lot of difference when you were in that shape. There was a car parked in my mother's front yard when I got home. I recognized Lester Flowers as I came to a stop, and I knew he wasn't there to serve as a welcome home committee. I got my mother settled in her house and returned to the car, where Flowers stood quietly on the driver's side while his two male companions remained inside. As I approached, I pulled Briscoe's gun out of my belt and fed around into the chamber. Flowers flinched and drew away at the sight of the weapon. "What the hell is that for?" he asked nervously. "Intimidation," I said. "That ain't very friendly," one of his companions, who sat in the front passenger seat, commented. He telegraphed me one of those grins that sought to be as intimidating as my weapon. "Ain't your goddamn friend," I retorted. "Tell me something I don't know," the companion answered with a heavy southern accent. "Crawford Sanderson's as loony as a bedbug," I answered, "so who the hell else is worried about me and what I might find?" "I told you before, you need to leave this alone," Flowers said. His face was intense as he spoke. "Is that what these people are here for? To help you convince me to leave this alone?" I decided the man in the front seat was the most dangerous one. He was one of those rednecks who looked like he didn't care about life, mine or his. Unlike his friend Flowers, he didn't look as if he needed to hide behind a sheet to do his killing. The man in the back was more obscured from my vision. He sat back in his seat and away from the door. He was quiet and more removed from the activity, but I kept watching his hands to be sure he didn't make a mistake and try to make a move on me. "There could be some money in this for you if you want to be cooperative," Flowers continued. His eyes darted nervously from my face to the gun. The redneck just sat there staring and grinning. I knew he was thinking and waiting, and if the opportunity arose, he would probably jump me and I would have to shoot him. "How much?" I asked. Flower's face suddenly looked hopeful. "Could be as much as, say, $100,000. He glanced toward the back seat as he stated the figure. I stood there trying not to let my face register the shock that had just rushed through me. I stepped closer to the car. The stakes were higher than I had even considered. This couldn't be just about nigger-hating Klansmen trying to keep somebody's good name from being soiled. This was rural North Carolina, where poverty and bigotry could make life as cheap as dry grass. You could get a black man killed for pocket change and pay for it with a post-dated check. Nobody paid $100,000 to cover up something that nobody would ever be convicted of anyway. Besides, old man Sanderson didn't have enough brain cells left to know whether he was being defamed or not. I saw the gleam in the redneck's eye and realized I had made a mistake, but it was too late. He shoved the passenger door open. It slammed into my legs and upper body, knocking me backwards to the ground. His tall, lanky frame was on top of me before I could scramble to my feet. I rammed my left forearm into his Adam's apple and jammed the muzzle of the .45 into his mouth. Blood splattered across my face as I felt it crunch through his teeth, and he rolled away, yelping like a hit dog. My adrenaline jerked me to my feet, and I trained the gun on the back seat of the car. It was a lesson learned from long ago. Eliminate the most viable threat. The redneck was already down. If I popped the guy in the back seat, then did the redneck, all I would have to worry about was Flowers, who was standing there white as a sheet with his hands on the roof of the car, looking like he was going to piss on himself in a minute. "Stop it! Y'all quit that. Quit it right now. You hear me?" My mother had come out on the front porch, and for some reason her presence and her voice put everything in a state of suspension. "Going back in the house, Mama, this ain't got nothing to do with you," I yelled. "Albert Lee, I'm your mother, and you don't talk to me like that. You don't tell me what to do." I wanted to say, "Yes, ma'am," but I was embarrassed, so I didn't say anything. I just stood there holding the gun, and nobody else moved or spoke. She stepped down from the front porch and came a bit closer. I could see her craning her neck to see who was inside the car. "Good afternoon, Mr. Sanderson," she addressed the man in the car. The rear door opened, and a man slightly older than me stepped out. He wore a white dress shirt without a tie and with the sleeves rolled up. He didn't bother to return her greeting. My mother walked closer and stood next to me. "Albert Lee, you should put that gun up. I don't think anyone wants to lose his life over this. You might want to hurt somebody, but you really shouldn't." The redneck had crawled back to the car and was leaning against it, holding his mouth, so I eased the gun into my belt. The trouble with growing up in a place where there is so much hate is you end up giving back as much as you receive, because it's the hate that helps you survive. I didn't want to raise my boy down here in this segregated, separate, but equal clan-infested place, but I didn't have a choice. This is where my husband lived and worked. My child grew up thinking that half of all the people in his world hated him, and even though he's gone on to see a better side, he can't get away from it. He would have killed all of y'all and ruined his own life, and he doesn't even understand why it would have been so easy for him. She was in her school teacher mode, and we all stood there almost as if in some surrealistic dream, listening respectfully. It had to do with Southern upbringing and respecting older people. No matter how mad you got, there were some things you didn't do in front of your mother or older women. This is Mr. Harold Sanderson. In a better world, you and my boy might have known each other, Mr. Sanderson. Might have been friends, but it's not a better world. And my boy thinks your daddy's first wife, Jazrene Smith, was killed by him or somebody he paid because he couldn't stand to have been fooled into marrying a colored woman. You know, my son used to talk to me when he was younger, but now he thinks I'm just an old woman whose mind isn't as good as it used to be. I could have told him that Crawford Sanderson didn't kill anybody. What do you know about this, Mama? I asked. I was almost too ashamed to ask her anything now because she was right. I hadn't gone to her, and it wasn't just her illness. I just didn't think my mother knew about things like this. Jazrene was a pretty woman. I don't know who she got her looks from, but it certainly wasn't from your Uncle Raymond. You see, the only folks who didn't know that Jazrene wasn't white were the white folks. Mr. Sanderson didn't suspect anything himself until the baby came out dark-skinned. Then he thought he could keep her and keep it hidden. He made the midwife take that baby and give it away. Do any of you know how hard it is to have your flesh and blood taken away from you? Do you know how she must have felt to be forced to give up her baby? Still nobody said anything. She turned to look directly at me. She left Crawford Sanderson. I don't think he ever knew where she went. White folks didn't wander through our neighborhoods looking for anything. She stayed over there with Matty Pierce for a while. Then one day she left and didn't come back. Maybe you need to stop worrying about whether the white folks killed Jazrene, Albert. Maybe nobody did anything to her other than what was already done. Maybe she killed herself. Maybe she took some poison and walked back in the woods by that old creek bed and lay down and died. Then what is this about? What are they afraid of? That man just offered me $100,000 to leave this alone. She paused and looked at flowers for a long time. It made him uncomfortable, and he fidgeted and looked at Sanderson. I wonder what happened to Jazrene's baby. He'd be 40-something by now. She said it in a slow, speculative manner, and Sanderson's reddened face told me she was right on the money. The old man was on his last leg. He couldn't live much longer. The paper mill, the entire pulp industry that he had nurtured was probably worth a considerable amount of money. And his son, by his second wife, certainly didn't need to have black men coming out of the woodwork claiming to be his long-lost stepbrother and trying to share the wealth. This was 1994, and the courts wouldn't be inclined to dismiss such a claim as they would have 40 years ago. Nobody's ever going to be able to figure out who he is, Sanderson finally said. What are we going to do? DNA analysis on every black man in Halifax County who thinks there's a possibility he could be my father's missing son? Where does it stop? He could be anywhere. He could have moved away to another state. Then what do we do? Go from state to state doing blood tests on black men? When the word gets out about how much money my father's estate is worth, they're going to come in here like a horde of locusts. He's probably right, Albert. Everybody who had anything to do with it is either dead or so old their minds are in the same shape as Crawford Sanderson. It might be best for everybody to just leave this whole thing alone. My mother coaxed me back toward the porch, and Sanderson, Flowers, and the redneck got back in their car and backed out to the road. I think we were all grateful to have extricated ourselves from this confrontation. I thought about what my mother had said for a long time. It wasn't as complete an answer as I wanted, but it did make a certain sense. Jazrene's bones hadn't been truly buried, just covered with a layer of silt and dirt that had accumulated over the years. I don't know why she went to the creek bed, maybe just because it was peaceful there. Poisoned animals always seemed to seek water. Maybe that was part of it too. I went back and stood by the place where I'd found the bones. I had the feeling that she was still there in some form, but I never saw her again. My mother had one of those last chores for me to do before going back to Atlanta. She sent me down to a little town called Scotland Neck, about 40 miles east of Macon, to have a mechanic service her 20-year-old car that had only been driven 30,000 miles on weekly excursions. It was one of those things I found easier to go through the motions of doing rather than trying to talk her out of it. When I arrived at the service station, I knew instantly why she had sent me. A very light-skinned black man in his 40s shook my hand and laughed when he saw her car. He confessed that he didn't know why she always drove all the way to Scotland Neck to get her oil changed. Maybe he didn't, but I did. I introduced myself, and we spent a long time talking about who he was, who I was, and who I thought he was. I was surprised at the curious discovery that my mother was a closet militant. She didn't want a gunfight in her front yard, but she wasn't about to let Harold Sanderson keep his family fortune all to himself. Briscoe Falcon couldn't stop laughing when I returned his gun and told him the story. Lord have mercy, whatever is Mr. Harold Sanderson gonna do with his newfound big brother, not even to mention the rest of y'all cousins and all? I can't say, but you call me up and let me know. I'm going back to Atlanta. Blood and color had always been mixed up in the South. It was a matter of who had the upper hand and who was in control of doing the acknowledging. The farther I got away from Roanoke Rapids, the less I felt of Jazreen's presence. Maybe it was just because her life, that part of it that lived in her child, was making its intended course, and she was finally at peace.
That was L.A. Wilson reading his 1997 story, Jazreen. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, a monthly magazine of short crime fiction published by Dell Magazines. This podcast was produced with the help of our assistant editor, Jackie Sherbo. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, www.themysteryplace.com, or look for us on Facebook. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital versions are now available from Amazon, Apple, Barnes & Noble, Google, Magster, Sony, and Cineo. Thanks for listening.